You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. We're going to try to get started. It is great to see this turnout, although not entirely surprising. We know there's a lot of pent-up interest in the climate issue, and also the meeting of the parties in Copenhagen was obviously an incredibly important and historic moment, and I'm not surprised that people are really curious to hear about it. I'm Nancy Heumann. I'm the Deputy Director of U.S. Programs, and I've also been working on OSI's climate-related grants and initiatives, and it was in that capacity that I went to Copenhagen. I ended up being there for most of the meeting. I'll tell you a little bit more in a second. We're joined by Mark Hertzgaard, who is an Open Society Fellow and a really quite extraordinary journalist who has been covering environmental issues and climate change specifically for several decades. He was among the first to write a book about it and to call the public's attention to the very serious issues of climate change, which, you know, we've all clearly woken up to now, and at the time it was much harder to get people to pay attention, but Mark was on this story very early on. He was in Copenhagen both as part of his fellowship, but also as part of his overall journalism related to climate and the environment. And I'm going to let him say whatever he wants to say more about who he is and what he was doing there. I guess the other thing that people will want to know is his main project as part of his fellowship is a book, which I'm pretty sure he's completed, right? It will be out later this year, early next year?
August.
So be on the lookout for that. And we're really, really excited to have him as a fellow, and it's great that he could be here to help me try to explain what the hell happened in Copenhagen. Oh, okay. So I'm going to start us off. You want me to start us off?
No.
Oh, yeah. So before we go into a form, this might be a little awkward since there's so many of you and because we need to use mics, but before we go into our own observations, we thought it might be really interesting to hear from some of you about what your impressions were of the Copenhagen meeting, either before, during, or after. We ourselves were in a bit of a bubble over there, so we didn't experience the coverage of it here for ourselves. We didn't learn about it the way all of you did. So if a few people could just tell us a little bit about what they know about it or think about it, and also where that information comes from, what sources you were trying to follow in order to learn about it.
Marcy Westerling. I wake up every morning to Democracy Now!, and so I would hear a very strong interpretation of what was going on in Copenhagen, and then the rest of the day I would either hear denials of any kind of global warming, or I would hear media stories that made it seem like it was a little chaotic and unruly and they needed a better nursery school teacher, but otherwise things were going swimmingly. So I felt that there was an enormous range of reality.
Thank you.
Sophia Conroy from U.S. Programs. I, in my personal life, read a lot of news about China and Tibet, and so a lot was circulating on our lists about that. A lot of analysis on from mainstream media, but also just other people's analysis on what a challenge the world has created in China and China's role in sabotaging the negotiations and sort of what that means in terms of dealing with China on any number of issues. So I'd love to hear sort of your insider take, because it's probably a skewed data source I had on that.
Maybe or maybe not, but thank you very much. Yeah, China and the China-US thing looms very large in all of this. Anybody else? Maybe one or two more, and then we'll get started.
Yeah, the thing that I found interesting about was the sort of the different objectives of developing versus developed countries. So if you could comment on that, certainly, and you know, what the onus is on developed countries in having contributed majorly to this problem, that'd be great.
Okay, anybody who got one more? Oh, great, Lee.
So I'm Lee Hollingby from the library. I also had the impression there was a major battle going on there between the developed and the developing countries, and it was playing out at the same time as the healthcare reform battle in the United States, and it seemed to me there were some similarities. I mean, there were certain senators holding the whole healthcare system hostage, and it seemed that a couple of countries to whom I was much more sympathetic than I was to the people who were holding the healthcare system hostage were also, you know, really holding out, you know, at the climate conference, maybe especially island nations that are very threatened by climate change. And also in the library, we do have a Nexus search that runs every day. So of course it picked up the role of George Soros, and I believe he made a major proposal around the time of the climate conference for a new climate institute, which I know is in an academic setting. And so I was very aware of that because I was seeing the news clips on that every day.
Okay, that was great. Thank you. And we welcome other people's comments when we get deeper into the discussion. So I think Mark's going to start off, and I really hope he's going to synthesize what for me has been something that's been very difficult to synthesize, since that's what journalists do. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark. And add to your introduction if you feel I did not do an adequate job.
More than adequate. I want to begin by saying how thrilled I am to see so many people here. I think it reflects both a deep-seated scientific reality that we are, as a species and a civilization, seriously up against it on this issue. And also, this reflects the growing awareness of this in the United States and in organizations in civil society. I'm going to talk a lot about civil society in the next few minutes because I think it's one of the real bright spots in an otherwise pretty gloomy picture that emerges from Copenhagen. As Nancy said, I've been covering climate change for 20 years now, and I remember covering the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, where the treaty that was being negotiated in Copenhagen was first signed. That's the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. That treaty is still in effect. Our nation has signed it. We signed it under the first President Bush. And the Kyoto Protocol, which is much better known, is actually an amendment to that treaty. So what was at issue in Copenhagen was extending and strengthening that same treaty. And it was very nice to hear a few people's reactions here. I'm going to start off by sharing the reaction of the country of Saudi Arabia, which I didn't cover at the time. I was over there, by the way, just parenthetically, again, thanks to the support of OSI. I was there doing reporting for the epilogue for my book, which will be out in August, and also covering the proceedings there for Vanity Fair magazine, The Nation magazine, and Marketplace Radio. And I wasn't able to include this in my reporting because it came afterwards, but it's such a revealing little fact that I thought I'd start with it today. The excellent BBC environment correspondent Richard Black. Any of you who really want to follow climate news, make the BBC your homepage. By far the best coverage of this stuff. And he must have a tie into the Saudis because he's got he's always doing stories. And he went to them after Copenhagen, had a long talk with them about how they felt about the results. And the Saudi Arabian delegate said that, "We are satisfied. We are satisfied." Pretty much that's all you need to know about why Copenhagen was such a disappointment. If the number one producer of oil in the world is satisfied with what happens there, that tells you something. But I want, because it's so easy to wallow in despair on this issue, I'm going to talk to you about the good news, because there's a lot of good news in the climate debate in general and at Copenhagen that unfortunately my colleagues in the media tend not to focus so much on. And I'm not doing this simply for cheerleading reasons, but because I believe that you have to have a serious understanding of where you are and how you got there if you're going to figure out where to go next. And there are good things, many good things to build on there. One specific date to keep in mind to preface all of this discussion. Copenhagen was often described as the last best chance for humanity to prevent catastrophic climate change. And so it's easy to say, oh, well, Copenhagen failed, we're doomed. But the key date was not December 2009 in Copenhagen. The relevant date is 2012, 2 years from now. That's when the major provisions of the Kyoto Protocol expire. And what that means is if we can still get significant agreements done and signed and approved in the next year or so, and there are two follow-up meetings to Copenhagen this year, we can still hit that 2012 date. So, first of all, there is still time, although the time gets shorter all the way. The second big piece of good news is that there was unprecedented engagement at Copenhagen by world leaders. And there were some very, very significant pledges of action. I'm thinking in particular of the European Union and Japan, both of which have pledged, and the European Union is still going to do, despite Copenhagen's failure. The European Union has pledged 20 to 30% emissions cuts by 2020. Biggest economy in the EU, Germany, has pledged 40% cuts by 2020. That's very much in line with what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says is necessary to limit the global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius, which is commonly, although not necessarily accurately, described as the threshold. Beyond 2 degrees C, it's really difficult to see how our civilization manages. So, Japan and the EU, the biggest economy in the world, Japan, also a very large economy, doing this. Even more encouraging, I think, and it got almost no attention that I could see in the U.S. media, is Brazil. One of the big developing nations, they were part of the last night of negotiations that Obama and the Chinese and others engaged in that produced the side deal known as the Copenhagen Accord. Brazil has promised 36% reductions in their emissions by 2020, largely through combating deforestation in the Amazon. That makes them the first genuinely developing country to come out with really ambitious targets. Other nations, Indonesia is talking about doing the same, and even China and the U.S., the two superpowers, who certainly bear most of the responsibility for the failure in Copenhagen. Nevertheless, if you compare where those two nations are today with where they were a year ago and where they have been for the last 20 years on this issue, it is an enormous shift. They have both agreed that they are going to limit their emissions. That's the first time that that's happened in all these 20 years. Their limits are nowhere near strong enough yet. But as I say, we have another 6 months to a year for civil society and others to be pressing them to do a lot better. There is movement underway in both countries, and very significantly, at the top of both countries, there is an understanding that fighting climate change is not only a national security imperative in terms of the impacts that lie in store, but is an enormous economic opportunity. I would say at this point, that understanding is far more advanced in China than it is in the United States. China clearly sees the green economy as the engine of growth in the 21st century, and they're doing a lot better than we are so far. But they've broken out of the old patterns, and it's up to civil society and others to keep pushing them to do more. The third factor that is, I think, a very good development and is equally important is that we saw in Copenhagen an unprecedented mobilization of civil society. As I mentioned, I've been covering these kinds of conferences since the Rio Summit in 1992, and activists and journalists and scientists have been calling for action against climate change throughout that time. There has never been the kind of presence, the kind of visibility, the kind of coordination within the various groups, and above all, the tangible influence on the summit itself that I saw in Copenhagen. We saw, I think, the emergence and perhaps even the coming of age in Copenhagen of a genuine mass movement, a global mass movement on behalf of climate action. I don't think the importance of that can be overestimated. If you look back at the great struggles in human history, whether it was abolishing slavery, getting the right to vote for women, creating the social welfare states in the advanced economies, including this one, great moral causes like this one never succeed without a mass movement. Governments will never do what is necessary when there's this much economic power at risk. And so I'm very encouraged by that. And I'll just cite a couple of examples. You know, governments now know that they are being watched on this issue like never before. And you couldn't miss it in Copenhagen. The signs were everywhere. But I'm going to talk about the tangible impacts. One thing that we definitely did as a civil society, and I include the media here, is that we kept Barack Obama, God bless him, and Wen Jiabing and the other world leaders from spinning this meeting as a success. And believe me, they were on the way to doing that. That Friday night, when Obama came out after his long negotiations and he gave a press conference and said this was an unprecedented breakthrough, I don't know how many of you were watching. I was watching very closely. The New York Times, within about 5 minutes of that press conference and finishing, had a headline up saying, "Climate deal in Copenhagen. Obama hails unprecedented breakthrough." And I was a little surprised at this because I had just heard what the Brazilian ambassador said about this, and it sure didn't sound like a breakthrough very much, and it also sounded like there were only five countries in the room. How is that a deal? So I called up the European Union press person, and amazingly, he picked up the phone, and I said, you know, what, are you guys part of this deal? He says, well, no, this is the first we're hearing about it. We haven't made a decision yet. So I took it upon myself to go over and see my esteemed colleagues at the New York Times table who were sitting there writing up their stories. And I said to one of them, who shall remain nameless, look, do you realize that your headline is giving the world the impression that there's been a success here in Copenhagen? And to this reporter's credit, this reporter said, I hear you. We're hearing that from other people, too. We're trying to figure out how to fix the top. In journalistic parlance, the top means the lead of the story. And you bet they were hearing it from other people. I'm not the only person who was involved in this. I went back to my desk at the far end of the media center. Within 10 minutes, the second paragraph had changed to say this was a side deal among only five countries. And as you went on and on, the rest of the media was following this up. And within 3 days, Barack Obama had come back to the United States, and instead of talking about the unprecedented breakthrough in Copenhagen, he was telling Jim Lehrer on the PBS NewsHour, quote, people have a right to be disappointed with Copenhagen. So that was one thing that happened. Another thing, much more important, I would say, is that this movement, and this is the example of the kind of influence that they have had in a very short period of time, this movement, they inserted their central demand into the negotiations in Copenhagen, the demand for a return to 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. Again, let me emphasize how big a shift that is. 2 years ago, that data point was not even a blip on the screen of the discussion. Since then, Jim Hansen at NASA has come out with a paper on it. Rajendra Pachauri, who's the scientist who heads the IPCC authority, has come out and endorsed that. Lord Nicholas Stern, Sir Nicholas, author of the Stern Report in Britain, the most authoritative analysis of the economics of climate change, has also endorsed it. Gore. More importantly, and Gore has endorsed it. But more importantly, you have groups, activist groups, all across this country and all around the world who have made a public campaign about it. You could not escape it in Copenhagen. I don't care if you were even one of those negotiators who was working 24/7. You walk through the hallways, you see 350 everywhere. You're on the metro, you see very clever ads by a group named Oceana saying, with the picture of a beautiful oyster, plate of oysters, saying, the price of an oyster dinner in 2050, 350 parts per million. The price of a dive vacation in 2050, 350 parts per million. And significantly, it was put into the negotiations by civil society working creatively with governments. And, you know, civil society needs to pressure governments, but at times you need to work with governments. And there, they worked with the governments, especially the governments of the Alliance of Small Island States around the world, 39 states like the Maldives and others who are basically going under the waves already. And they put this forward as a draft text on about halfway through the negotiations, calling for 350 parts per million. That 350 parts per million has now been endorsed officially by most of the world's governments. Is there a person in this room who knows that fact? You don't read that in the New York Times. You haven't even heard that on the BBC yet. Yet it's a fact. Now, more than 100 governments endorsing a position that 2 years ago was seen as
a joke,
politically naive, even self-defeating, economically ruinous. That is now in the negotiations. Those are, granted, weaker countries, poorer countries, etc. But that is another reason that when Obama and the BASIC group came with their side deal, the so-called Copenhagen Accord, that's why the entire summit explicitly declined to endorse that. And instead, they quote-unquote took note of it. Because you did see, and to answer your question, there was I'd say unprecedented kind of collaboration and cooperation, not just between civil society and governments, but especially the governments in the developing world. There are also, and we can get into this in the question period, also significant divides, especially between China and the developing countries. But anyway, the point of that, and a prediction here, the new champion of this, and perhaps the leader of this movement, is Mohamed Nasheed, the president of Maldives, an incredibly admirable man, a freedom fighter, the first democratically elected president in his nation's history, spent 4 years in solitary confinement fighting the dictatorship, and now is the one leading the fight for 350 parts per million, because he says we need not to limit the temperature rise to 2 degrees C, we need to limit it to 1.5 degrees C, because otherwise a country like mine, the Maldives, is going to be underwater. When I interviewed him, he said, I said, you know, people say you're tilting at windmills. He said, well, our argument is really quite simple. We believe that people will agree not to murder others. And if it's more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, we've had it. We're underwater. And again, the African nations say much the same thing. 1.5 degrees globally means at least a 3 degrees centigrade rise in inland areas like Africa. And you're essentially writing off large portions of the human race if you agree to that. And one final note on this. Again, you know, it wasn't a complete victory, but even that Copenhagen Accord signed by Obama and the Chinese in one of the last paragraphs includes now 1.5 degrees C. They don't endorse it. By the way, they also don't endorse the 2 degrees C. I know the media told you that they did. They don't. They just take these. They take note of the scientific view of 2 degrees, but they do say at the end that they're going to re-examine the science going forward in the years to come and see whether 1.5 degree makes more sense. Now, we can talk a lot about all of that going on later, but I think I'll stop here and just say it is very true that Copenhagen was not a victory for civil society. I don't want to be misunderstood here. But again, look back in history. These kinds of movements never win right away. They're asking for too big a change. You don't get that kind of change right away. The way you get that change, though, is to be persistent, to realize how far you've moved the struggle forward, and to look back at what you've done that has given you your successes. Also look back at what you've done that has not worked so well, and be prepared to jettison the ideas, the tactics, the strategies that aren't working, and to embrace and intensify the ones that are. And I hope that's the discussion that we'll have here today and that certainly we're trying to promote in the pages of The Nation and elsewhere and all the other parts of civil society in all the different areas that you all work in. We've all got to be looking at this because, again, if we don't solve this problem, there is not going to be any open society. There's not going to be any civil society. I'm very sympathetic, needless to say, for the need for health care reform in this country. But having a good U.S. health care system is not going to matter on a planet that is unlivable. And we have very, very little time to get this right. But I still insist that we can if we build on the successes that we saw in Copenhagen. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you so much, Mark. I pretty quickly want to turn it over to questions, but I first wanted to give people a flavor for, you know, what was OSI doing in Copenhagen? Why did I go? Somebody made mention of the fact that George came and put a proposal on the table. So I thought people would be a little curious about that, and I'll talk a little bit, and then we'll open it up for questions. Just one thing. I could not agree more with both the content of what Mark just said, but also the tone. I was following this extremely closely while I was in Copenhagen, and I've read a lot about what happened there and what it means and what it adds up to. I've been to a number of meetings and on a lot of conference calls with funders and NGOs and a number of other kinds of people to try to put it all together and understand what happened, both like legal details as well as the broader meaning. And I think that there's a lot of dissonance in the reporting. It was bad. It was a good start. It was a disaster. It was a train wreck. Obama's a hero. You know, et cetera. And I kind of think it's all true. And even though it seems like it's all in disagreement, the coverage, you know, some of it contradicts others, I really truly believe it's all true because I believe that it depends a little bit what your reference point is. And so I really love the way Mark put it. On the one hand, did we achieve what we needed to achieve? Did we get a legally binding agreement that's actually going to get us on the road to fixing this problem? No, by that measure, it was a big flop, which is a word George has been using to describe it. But if you compare it to what we could have imagined that the world as a whole would agree to, what the U.S. would do, what China would do, I don't think you mentioned India, but you know, as of 6 months ago, India was saying, it's your problem, you created it, we're not going to do anything, and yet in advance of the talks, they actually came out with a plan of action. And when you make that list, I really think it does add up to a very, very different world view. One thing to watch for is what happens in the next few weeks. The Copenhagen Accord was noted. It set up a process that requires all of the countries to, one, associate themselves with it, which they need to do by the end of the month, and it's really on January 31st, I think, that we'll know what that looks like. If a huge number of countries associate themselves with it, that's a sign that it has some meaning. If huge numbers don't, then I think we'll know that it's not very meaningful. The other thing is that it has these empty charts at the end of it, and the so-called Annex 1 countries, which are basically the developed world as defined during Kyoto, needs to send in each of their commitments, and there are processes underway in all of these countries to determine what the commitments are that they're going to pledge. And the non-Annex 1 countries, which is the developing countries, are also asked to pledge their own actions toward climate. So here again, I think what people or what countries submit by January 31st is a really, really important indicator about whether the Copenhagen Accord has any even politically binding power. So I just wanted to say that. One other footnote to Mark's talks. I mean, for those of you who aren't following this as closely, I could not agree more that the prominence of 350 parts per million as a target is a huge, another one of these watershed changes. But I'd like to note that we're at about 387 right now. And if we continue with business as usual, we're on a track to something very, very unlivable for the planet. It depends on kind of what projections you look at, but like if we just continue doing exactly what we're doing, it's like in the 700s. So getting to 350, as important a goal as it is, requires a lot of action on the parts of lots of countries really, really, really fast, and probably most primarily action on the part of the United States. So what was I doing there? You know, I've been working on the climate issue with people at OSI for the last 4 or 5 years. We have a number of grantees. We don't have a formal program, as most people know, but we have a number of grantees. My main objective when I made plans to go was to see our grantees in action, to help in whatever ways I could with the advocacy that they were undertaking. A number of them were involved in the tremendous civil society outpouring that you saw there, Avaaz, Energy Action Coalition, et cetera. And I went for educational and networking purposes because obviously, like, this is where everybody collects once a year, anybody who cares about climate. And there's a huge amount to learn. There's a huge number of side events that are like graduate level courses in anything and everything climate related. And I went to learn as much as I could and understand how the climate issue intersects with open society issues. So those were my main objectives originally, but about a week before the meeting was to start, George Soros decided that he wanted to go and talk about special drawing rights. And some of you may have been following this. He's been talking about the idea of using special drawing rights, which I'll explain in a second, to fund a number of very, very hard to fund global public goods. Response to climate change, Millennium Development Goals, other development-related things. It's not a hugely new idea for him. It's very little understood in much of the rest of the world, and he made a decision to focus his advocacy on special drawing rights on the climate issue in the context of Copenhagen because he thought maybe it could get more elevation, might be a good word for it, if you just really focused on it and if we could get the climate-oriented and interested communities educated and interested in the issue. What special drawing rights are, you can go and look at a wiki. It'll do a much better job of explaining it than I can. But in very, very simple terms, it's basically It's a currency that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, can create. The IMF can essentially create money. It's like a parallel mint to our mint or the British mint or the euros or what have you. And for this reason, it's potentially of great interest to the developed world because it's a way for the developed world to donate money to the cause of addressing climate without charging it to their existing books. So I'm not going to go any deeper into it. If people have questions, we can talk about it separately. But that's the essential idea. For it to work, we really need to get governments probably to take hold of the issue. And so that's what George went to Copenhagen to do. And that's what I ended up spending most of my time doing, was trying to figure out how do we insert this into the negotiations, who among the countries who were there might be interested and might be influential, who was in Copenhagen was influential with those people who might be influential. And it was really a great education in how the UNFCCC process works. And also in international diplomacy. It was fascinating. George made quite a splash. His timing was good because the talks at the time were kind of stalled because Tuvalu, which you probably read, had thrown this kind of wrench into the works. And so many of the negotiators were walking around. They had nothing else to do. It also came during the first week of the negotiations, which tend to be quieter than the second week. And sort of spontaneously, We got meetings with anyone and everyone, practically. It was truly astonishing how much attention we could get. And part of that was George being there and doing the talking himself, and part of it really was, I think, timing. And the other really important thing that was happening is there's a tremendous need to find money to deal with the climate problem. And nobody really knows where all this money is going to come from. And so if you come with an idea about where some of this money might be found, and if it has the additional appeal of not costing the countries anything in a certain way, it, as you might imagine, becomes of interest to huge numbers of people. And so having George there to advocate for it was really, really, really important, and there probably are lots of opportunities for us to follow up on this in the days ahead. It's not an easy fight. There's a lot of technical issues with it. There also are political issues with it, and we're going in with our eyes pretty wide open on those things, but George feels like it's still really important and quite viable, and he's going to spend a lot of time when he's in Davos later this month talking to people about using special drawing rights to finance the climate needs of the developing world. So that's the SDRs thing. I'm happy to take questions on it when we get to questions. I kind of wanted to give people a little bit of just a few kind of almost random observations, which to me were really quite interesting. The first thing came up a little bit in one of the questions, which is, you really saw our changing geopolitics on display. If you take the climate issues out of it, which it's hard to do, and you just think about the role that the U.S. played and the role that China played and the role that Europe played, it's a very, very different world than the world we are used to. The Europeans are still trying to figure out what their role is in all of this. You basically had these two poles, the U.S. and the China. Really, really quite fascinating. And I think neither of them really understands how to play in this changed environment. China wants to have it both ways. They both want to be a developing country. They also want to have the power and authority of a developed country. And we, the U.S., haven't quite figured out how to deal with that. And then, as I said, the Europeans are trying to figure out what their role is, et cetera. Very, very interesting. I think there are real questions about the U.N. process. The U.N. process itself, some people would say, got in the way of an agreement. The UN process, others would say, is protecting the voices of smaller countries with less power, many of whom are the likely worst victims of climate change. And I think there are real questions about what venue these discussions continue in. There are UN discussions on the schedule, but there's also the G20. There's something called the Major Economies Forum, which is something that the U.S. started under Bush, and it was largely a fig leaf to make it look like the U.S. was doing something when it wasn't. The Obama administration decided to hang on to it, but turn it into something real, which they've tried very hard to do. And I heard Todd Stern, who's the chief negotiator for the U.S., talk last week for the first time publicly about what happened in Copenhagen and the road ahead. And he was asked a very pointed question about the Major Economies Forum and said that he wasn't sure what venues these discussions would play out in, but that you needed something like the Major Economies Forum, or there was a group of 30, a larger group of countries in Copenhagen that were consulted after the five countries came up with the accord, and they were consulted ahead of time. I mean, in his mind, you need a smaller group of nations to make real progress on the issue. That's a real problem for much of the world. Very interesting development, not clear at all how it gets worked out. I guess the last thing I want to make a small comment on is the role of the U.S. I mean, a lot of the reason why nothing or very little could happen in Copenhagen and why the whole thing almost really did collapse is because the U.S. had failed to take action on climate. The rest of the world is waiting for us. A number of people commented while we were there, I'm sure you heard it, Mark, too, that the U.S. Senate is basically governing the whole rest of the world on this issue. The whole rest of the world is waiting now for the U.S. Senate to act. It's a kind of shocking and upsetting realization, but you know, it leads us to where we as a foundation and where George personally has been for the last few years, which is we have to do everything we can to get the U.S. to act and to act in a very ambitious way. It will unleash incredible action in the rest of the world. You've already seen some of that as Obama has taken the even baby steps that he's taken. I don't think it was a coincidence that China announced targets like the next day and that India came shortly after that. This was all in the lead up to Copenhagen. And the last thing I would say about it is that Obama needs this as much as the world needs it. A huge piece of his base of support is really waiting for it. Climate and environmental activists in the U.S. are extremely distressed about the way healthcare has really dragged out and how difficult it has become to even think about getting climate and energy legislation in this country. But he himself needs it. And after having put himself on the line in Copenhagen, I think there's a tremendous amount of hope that he'll step up and show real leadership on the issue. So I think I'm going to leave it at that. Mark, do you want to comment quickly on anything I said, or do you want to open it up?
Let's hear the questions.
All right, great. So questions, comments.
Here's a microphone.
I'm Steve Hubble from the Open Society Fellowship Program and from the Department of Communications. Thanks to both of you for being our eyes and ears on the ground in Copenhagen, our deep cover operatives sending back the privileged intelligence. It's good to get the inside story. My question touches on something both of you raised, which is we meet today on the eve of what may be the demise of Obama's parliamentary supermajority. There's an election today in Massachusetts that is not looking good. When Obama was elected, I think many of us took it as an article of faith that green technology and green investment might possibly be a means of deliverance both from our economic woes and also from our environmental the looming environmental catastrophe. With enough support from governments like the United States, the EU, and China, and with enough support from foundations like our own, that was going to be a kind of force multiplier, that we would find that that the potential for green technology to offer an alternative future would be decisive. And now, a year later, a year plus later, it seems as if those early promises were largely oversold. I'm wondering what you saw in Copenhagen that led you to believe, either to be hopeful or more hopeful or less hopeful about the capacity of green technology specifically and the future of investment in green technologies as a meaningful mode of deliverance in the near term.
I saw good things and bad things in Copenhagen on that front. I think it is definitely true that President Obama understands in a way that no president has before that fighting climate change is going to save the economy and not ruin the economy. And he has done more than talk about that rhetorically. If you look in the very first stimulus package, there's about $20 billion. Granted, that's not a lot out of $750 billion, but still $20 billion where I come from is real money. And $20 billion going into green types of investments. And some of them in particular into energy efficiency improvements in the schools and so forth. So the White House, I think, at the very top, understands this in theory. Where I would give them much, much lower grades, and where I would include the vast bulk of the mainstream environmental movement in this country, is that they have done a terrible job of messaging this, of speaking to the country about it. You now have a situation where the president has lost control of the narrative around healthcare He is seen as someone who's going to deliver a tax on people's health care. He has lost control of the narrative around the banks. He is seen as on the side of these greedy fill in the blank. Although last week we saw them beginning to find their feet on that with putting out the soundbite of "We want our money back," that's good. Too bad it wasn't 6 months ago. And he has lost control of the narrative on climate change. He is being painted again there as a taxer, as someone who's going to cost the economy jobs. The truth is quite the opposite. And one quick factoid that should be coming out of almost every, you know, White House speech, and they should be doing a lot more on this. He has not spent anywhere near the kind of time and effort and political capital on this that he could have, especially because it's a winning message, not a losing message, is the enormous amount of money that can be made by doing this, money that right now the public sector, that we the taxpayers are leaving on the table, money that the private sector is very definitely not leaving on the table. And the great irony is that some of the greatest polluters in the world are the ones who are making the most money from green technologies. Energy efficiency in particular, a little company called British Petroleum in 1999 decided to turn over a new leaf, and they said, you know, on our internal operations, we're going to invest in energy efficiency in our refineries, our offices, etc. They invested $20 million in retrofitting all that stuff, and 3 years later, they audited it, and they found that $20 million investment had yielded $650 million of lower costs. That is a 32 times larger return on investment. You cannot get that kind of return on investment if you are organized crime. You know, and that is the kind of money that the public sector is leaving on the table. And so it is still there as a potential. But you have got to fix something inside the White House, inside the staff there probably, because the president clearly understands that intellectually, but it is not at all coming across to the public. And it is an enormous, enormous lost opportunity. And it is why I would not be at all surprised, regardless of what happens in Massachusetts, if we don't see the Waxman-Markey bill pass the Senate. Accompanying legislation passed the Senate, because there's a lot of people, Democrats and Republicans alike, who think this is going to be economically ruinous. And if we don't see some kind of action out of the United States, it is very hard to press China, who needs to be pressed, and other countries to do what we need in the months ahead.
Waxman-Markey is the piece of legislation that was passed in the House earlier this year on climate and energy. It would create a cap and trade system in the U.S. and do a whole bunch of other things. There's a short-term, long-term issue here. I mean, I think it's possible that it was kind of oversold as a savior in the short term. I think there's no question that it is the economy of the future. China clearly has this figured out. They're doing a ton of stuff. You know, they're governed in a different way, which makes it a different situation for them to begin to do those things. But we have to get started in the U.S. There's kind of no question about that. Other questions? Comments? Dan?
Some of what I've read, and I would guess most prominently in The Economist, I've seen an argument kind of that this comprehensive approach, the Kyoto, Copenhagen kind of approach, is not really the way to go. And rather that, you know, better to take this in a more piecemeal fashion. Would that be kind of death by a thousand mini Copenhagens, or is it actually something that we should really consider, kind of slicing this up into smaller pieces, deforestation, other things like that? I guess that's it. Yeah.
Who are you, Dan?
I'm Dan Sershin with the Office of International Operations.
Do you want to take that one, or you want
sure.
me to?
Look, I think it's a mistake to rule out anything at this point. You know, we are into overtime on this issue. And I'm not surprised to hear that The Economist looking at it that way. It tends to be the more mainstream establishment people like Todd Stern inside the government who say, look, this UN process, it's too unwieldy. Let's just get the big emitters together and cut a deal. I don't see a problem with that happening, alongside of a UN process, but just remember why they don't like that UN process. It's because poor people get a vote, right? And poor people are the ones who are going to get hammered on this. And if there were that kind of decision-making process, we would have had the Copenhagen Accord stuffed down the throats of the world, and that would condemn a very large part of the human population to an unlivable climate. So I think that it is all to the good if we can get, and we haven't touched on this, but cities and states and regions. Schwarzenegger announced something in Copenhagen, the founding of the R20, regions around the world, yeah, who are going to be doing emission stuff. All of that is to the good. All the momentum that we can build. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to have to get a global agreement on this stuff, too. And I think the two, one of the challenges is for us to figure out how to have a big enough tent without watering down the demands to say, okay, these things can happen in concert, but at the end of the day, let's remember that everybody has to be part of solving this problem.
I just want to add that you have a sort of a mirror image issue or question about what to do in the U.S. There's a lot of conversation about whether to break it apart, whether to do a comprehensive climate and energy policy here, whether to break it into pieces, and I do think it would be death by 1,000 cuts in the U.S. Going for the comprehensive thing needs to be the objective. And for instance, there's been a lot of talk about whether to have an energy-only bill, and I don't think we'll get anything like what we need related to climate, and then we probably won't get another whack at climate for a very long time. So just to apply that same question to the situation in the U.S., I mean, I think the answer is a little bit different. Mm. So next question.
My name is Marcy Westerling, and thank you both for especially trying to put it in some positive frames. I have a question. I'm an on-the-ground community organizer predominantly in rural America. And so global warming doesn't exist. But anyway, I was recently really shocked by this graph, which I'm afraid is too small for anyone to see, but it's a Pew study that looks at the change by party affiliation, Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, from 96 to 09, no, 2006 to 2009, and shows an incredibly sharp drop-off in people's ability to believe that global warming is in fact happening. So that, to me, is really, really a good reminder that, much like healthcare shocked us all by becoming a culture war issue, that global warming is also, at least in this country, and so if we're going to try and catch up our civil society in pushing for this country to be a part of any policy fixes, we're moving in the wrong direction. So I was hoping you could tell us how to fix that.
Mark, do you want to take a crack at that?
I appreciate your question, Marcy, and I also appreciate the work that you're doing. So congratulations on that. That's civil society in action.
Definitely.
And one of the things that I forgot to mention, one of the great victories of civil society that, again, you aren't reading about in the New York Times, is that that local activists in this country have basically, over the last year and a half, brought about a de facto moratorium on new coal-fired power plants. There were 240 online or planned about 2 years ago. More than 100 of those are now definitively canceled, and the other 100 are all under siege because of people at the local levels, many in so-called red state areas, which brings me to the second point, which is I'd be a little cautious about those Pew numbers. I have been following the numbers on this issue for a long time, and I'm not persuaded by them. And others who have polled on this issue for a long time point out that Pew has not been polling on this issue for a long time and is basically comparing apples and oranges. And I have seen over the years spikes and valleys and spikes and valleys in these things. So I say that not to diminish the importance, though, of continuing that cultural sort of work in terms of talking to people about climate change and so forth, but let's not necessarily think that things are worse than they are, because you can also see, not in Pew, but an equally reputable pollster just came out with a number saying that 2/3 of the American public want action taken on climate change, even though it's going to cost them money. Well, both of those two things cannot be true.
Right.
And a lot of polling, I've written a lot about polling in my career, and just always be careful when journalists report on polls.
Yeah.
You know, our editors love polls, because as soon as there's a poll, then you can write a trend story saying that, oh, you know, whatever it is. And in this particular issue, the sort of the deniers look at that and say, we're winning. Whereas the people on this side will say, we need more funding to go out and fight this. And oftentimes, it's just not really true.
I couldn't agree more. The only thing I would add is that I think it's also really important to pick it apart a little bit. And similar polling on the solutions to global warming poll really well and in our favor. So if you talk about the benefits to the economy of clean tech kinds of jobs, it does extremely well. And early in the legislative fights on both this issue and healthcare, I saw polling that showed just the opposite for healthcare. The public really doesn't like the solutions to the healthcare problem. I mean, understands the need for healthcare reform, and it was quite a contrast, because in many ways you can look at those issues as being somewhat similar in terms of where the opposition is, where the support is, et cetera. And in many cases, it's the exact same states and the exact same congressional delegations that need some work. But it's very interesting when you dig a little bit deeper into how people really feel about how you solve the problem.
Criminal Justice Fund. So this question about how poor Obama's messaging has been on these three crucial issues, but particularly talking about climate, why has he been so bad? Why have they been so bad? And who's working on it, and how could it get better?
Why have they been so bad? That is a story I hope to do. So I can't pretend to know the inside answers. I just watch how the White House has worked, and it is baffling, because here's a guy who, as a candidate, really had the touch, knew how to speak to the people, and yes, of course, you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose, but that doesn't mean your prose has to be this clunky. It just doesn't, you know. Likewise, he came to Copenhagen, a guy who is still much beloved around the world, and who almost never gives a bad speech. He gave the worst speech I've ever seen him give in Copenhagen. It was petulant. It was impatient. It was almost lecturing, and it was take it or leave it. So I think that internationally his image got hurt in Copenhagen. So why are they doing this? I suspect it has to do with they have a very inside Washington view of the world. The Rahm Emanuel view of the world, that it's all about cutting deals in Congress and all of that, and they forget that you've got to be able to talk to the public. I mean, and it's just so insane, because they've got the single best communicator we've had, you know, easily back to Reagan, if not more than Reagan. And so why they're doing that is, as I say, a story I hope to explore. How it can get better is something that I think that our side needs to be working on desperately, and funding, but it's going to take some tough love, because there's an awful lot of environmental NGOs who still don't quite get it, that you've got to have a positive message, that what you know inside of your little offices is not what the average American knows out there. You may all know that fighting global warming can be good for the economy. Believe me, the average American doesn't know that. And you've got to invest in that. Most of what happens, it's a podcast, I'm still going to say it. Most of what happens, most environment, and I'm on the receiving end of this as a journalist, most of what environmental groups' media messaging is about is getting their names in the paper and getting their projects in the paper. That's the primary focus. And if those projects, many of them are you know, certainly fine, but are they really shifting the debate? It's not about getting your name in the paper. It's about shifting the debate. It's about moving it forward. And that was, again, one of the very good things at Copenhagen, that groups were able to come together around a demand of 350 that was seen as impossibly naive. Well, they succeeded in putting that right into the middle of the debate. So I think one thing I would suggest for the American groups is to look at what happened there, learn.
I think there are a couple of pieces of this that I just want to make quick comments on. The first is to go back to how Mark characterized President Obama's posture in Copenhagen. I mean, I think Mark got it largely correct. That was also the posture, basically, of the U.S. negotiators, although I will say that, you know, their frustration built over the course of the weeks. But I think that that was really driven by domestic politics. President Obama went to Copenhagen with a really lousy hand. The thing the White House was most concerned about, at least from what we were hearing, is that things get set up in such a way that we could actually try to move legislation in the Senate. And the Senate is tremendously concerned about the role that China plays. And so there's a lot of analysis out there that suggests that the U.S. posture was really related to positioning itself for the fight in the Senate. So that's one thing I would say. And, you know, and to add to that is just that is not well understood in the rest of the world. On the one hand, they understand that Senate action is required and the Senate is kind of holding things up. On the other hand, there was a tremendous expectation that the president was going to come and bring all kinds of goodies to the table that his negotiators had not put on the table. And it's simply not true. And I think the negotiators were trying to help other parts of the world understand that this was the best that the U.S. could do. It wasn't going to get any better when the president came. It was a tremendously difficult negotiating position for the U.S. So that's one thing. To go back to what's happening in the U.S., I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a bit of a rift in the White House between kind of the money people and the other people. The Treasury Department and the economic advisors have been a lot more cautious than I think those of us who are interested in seeing climate action would like. They're also tremendously influential. So I think that's a piece of it. You know, I want to point out that we have practically our dream slate of people running environment and climate stuff in this administration. I mean, Mark may disagree with me, but I mean, it's really a very, very classy and high-level crew of people. Steve Chu at Energy, John Holdren, one of the nation's leading climate scientists, is the science advisor. Carol Browner, et cetera. I mean, EPA, Lisa Jackson is like a rock star now. She has her own Facebook group with thousands and thousands and thousands of fans. Nancy Sutley in the White House. It really is the A-team. So this is a good question. Like, why isn't more happening? I think healthcare has really gotten in the way. And then, you know, the last thing I would say on it is I don't think this is a job for the environmental community. I think this is a job for all of us. And, you know, to answer these economic questions and to deal with the people in the Treasury and the economic advisors who are naysayers, I think we need business to speak much louder about the need and desire and the tremendous positive outcomes. from making the economic transformation that we need to make in this country. And that's not to say that there aren't jobs that will be dislocated and human beings who will be affected, but over the long haul, there is no question that we need to make this transformation. And I actually think it's non-environmental voices that are really key to carrying that message forward. Well, I think that, I mean, Susan asked the question about whether things are, whether this aspect of it is going better in Europe and abroad. I mean, I think they're starting from a really different place, and it's very hard to make that comparison. I mean, in Europe and abroad, I mean, they think it's, they can't believe we're still debating the science here. So to go back to Marcy's point, I mean, you know, they're sort of dumbfounded by the state of the debate here. I think, you know, so because of that, because there's a lot more public will, at least in Europe, I mean, you see much more progressive policies on all this stuff. Obviously, the Europeans have taken targets. They've got a functioning trading system. You see things like the feed-in tariff in Germany. There's all kinds of really great stuff happening, like all kinds of offshore wind stuff in the UK. You know, look, we can't even get Cape Wind approved. So... although supposedly there's going to be a decision by April, I think, or by March, soon. So I think it's hard to make that comparison, actually.
I do think it's true the business people have to speak up more. They did speak out, but that's another area where there has to be much more of a push. It's also important to recognize that the outside world, of course, they see the role of the Senate, but they would also point out that... it's simply not true that the U.S. can't do better than this. They all know that 3 days before the Copenhagen summit began, the EPA affirmed its authority to regulate greenhouse gases. The EPA on its own can do this, could deliver all of the emissions reductions that the science says is necessary by 2020. It is indeed legally obliged to do that. If you look at the statute of the Clean Air Act, the EPA is obliged to do what is necessary to protect the public health, regardless of whether it is seen as economically viable or not. It is a technology-forcing statute in the sense that the government is supposed to say, we need this level of protection, and private industry, you figure out how to get us there. So they know that Obama has got a big club in his hand, and they keep saying, when is he going to use it? And why are you telling us that this bill in your Congress, they know how weak that bill is. They know far more about American politics than most Americans do. And they know that that bill, and more than I'm very sorry to say many members of Congress do on climate. I have never been more disappointed than the day in Copenhagen where I went to the press conference with Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and Henry Waxman and Ed Markey and all the others, and they were there to tell the world press that we've changed in Washington, we're serious, we're going to get this, here's the bill that we're after. Well, the bill that and they say, we're going to cut emissions 17% by 2020. Well, the whole rest of the world knows that 17% number is bollocks, that they're moving the goalposts. Their 17% from 2005 is not the same as 17% from 1990, which is, oh, by the way, the standard the entire rest of the world uses. It's like promising to kick a 40-yard field goal and then teeing the ball up on the 10-yard line. And you want everybody to applaud you? That is why the rest of the world is so frustrated, because they see that Obama is, in fact, handicapping himself. He has that EPA authority. What you will hear from people is that, oh, well, it's better to pass a bill. Well, of course it's good to pass a bill. But why not, in the meantime, go ahead with this authority, and you would send the price signal, which is really what you need to have happen, send the price signal so that all of this capital that is waiting around the world will say, okay, we're going to go into this, and we see a profitable investment environment. At that point, it creates, I think, much more opportunity to pass a bill. You know, the idea of the White House is we're going to hold this club and use it to get wavering senators to back the climate legislation. Well, gee, that's working out really well, isn't it? You know, right now that legislation is looking like it's going down to defeat, and he is still holding the club back in the basement. I mean, bring it out, man, because this is going to be seen, whether they realize it or not, inside the White House. This is going to be a defining issue of his presidency, And as Nancy alluded to earlier, it is also arguably the number one issue for the constituency that did the most to get him elected, which was young people. This is by far the issue that is the most energizing. There are 700 campuses in this country now who have done enough activism to force their administrations to go carbon neutral. They are going to remember it in 2012 when he runs again if he does not deliver on this issue.
We are out of time. Can I suggest that if anyone has any burning questions that didn't get answered, that you are welcome to follow up with me, and also I'm sure Mark would make himself available, in addition to which we never got into all the really colorful stuff that happened in Copenhagen. So if you want to hear about, like, people wearing green face paint and, like, the celebs and the incredible sculptures and art exhibits and documentary photography and all the stunts and demonstrations, there's a lot of color that we would be happy to share, too, because it truly does have a kind of carnival aspect to it, in addition to very, you know, sober public policy conference aspect. So thank you all so much for coming. It was great turnout.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
My pleasure.